Parsha Shelach, of course, dominated by the Shiluach HaMeraglim, and the discussion, not surprisingly, with regards to this episode, begins at the beginning. As Moshe is told, in the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe l'Emosh Shelach Lecha Anoshim V'yosur As Eretz Kanan. And interestingly, as we know, Rashi's first comment precedes even an explanation of the word Shelach Lecha. It's about the timing of the Parsha. Rashi comments, Lama nismecha Parshas Meraglim leParshas Miriam. As sometimes the case, Rashi's opening comment of the Parsha is a global one. Before getting down to the pieces of the psukim, it's about the juxtaposition, it's about the geography of the parshas of the Torah. How is it that this parsha is the appropriate one to follow on from the most previously mentioned parsha? And that, of course, refers to the end of Parshas Baalosecha, where Batadaber Miriam Ba'aron, Ba'Moshe, they spoke about Moshe, and it was incorrect, and the next thing we know, Shlach Lecha Anoshim. Lama nismecha Parshas Meraglim leParshas Miriam. What's the connection between these two things? Says Rashi, and this is sourced in the Medrash, Lefi sheloksa al iske diba, shedibra be'acheha, because Miriam came to grief over improper speech. She spoke disparagingly, critically, where it was inappropriate, and she suffered as a result of that. Urishoyim halalu, and then contrast these, Rashi calls them Rishoyim, in this context. Ro, they saw this. Velolok humusim, they didn't take a lesson. In other words, they should have thought twice before speaking disparagingly about Eretz Yisrael. After all, they have a living example in front of them of what happens if a person says something negatively that they shouldn't have said. The words of Rashi are well known, I believe. And what's very interesting is, and this is a matter of concern for all of the Meforshei Rashi, is that they're wondering, why is Rashi talking about this? And the background to the question is, Rashi once in a while gets involved in Smichus Parshias. What is this Parsha? Why is it written after the other Parsha? But we must understand that Rashi's discussions of Smichus Parshias partake of the same nature of Rashi's discussions throughout the Torah. Namely, Rashi will comment if something in the Pasuk seems amiss, seems out of place. If something says Darsheni, Rashi says Hineni. But if that's the case, then what happens if you have two parshas that, as far as we know, happened one after the other? In such an instance, there should be no basis for Rashi to raise the question, Lama nismecha, what is Parsha B doing after Parsha A? If Parsha B happened after Parsha A, and there's nothing to intuit that happened in between, or should have been in between, so you can never ask, why are they together? Because why shouldn't they be together? One happened after the other. The only time Rashi will ever ask Lama nismecha, certainly when it comes to matters of history in the Torah, is if there's reason to suspect that they did not happen one after the other. Something else should have been here, but it wasn't here. These two parshas seem to have been artificially fused or juxtaposed one with the other. Why would that be? That's a Rashi question. But as we know, there is every reason to understand that the parsha of Shiluach Meraglim happened immediately after the parsha of Miriam. After all, they moved straight after Miriam v'achar nasa'u from Chatzeros to Midbar Paran, and then Moshe sends Meraglim from Midbar Paran. We're not aware of anything that happened in between. And that being the case, we have a question on Rashi's question, because Rashi's question, Lama nismecha, is preempted by our reaction, Lama lo nismecha. Why would it not be put together? And if there is no argument to prize them apart, then there is no comment-worthy feature of the fact that they are together And why is Rashi getting involved here? And this question is raised by from the first of the Mefarshei Rashi till the last, and I wonder if there's anyone in between who hasn't spoken about it. A very interesting approach, which is taken by a number of Mefarshim, is that actually we're dealing with a somewhat atypical case of Smichus Parshius Rashi here, for reasons that we will explain. As we know, the idea to send Meraglim initiated with the Bnei Yisrael themselves. Very interestingly, this is something which is not mentioned at the beginning of Shelach. If you only ever learned Shelach, you would never know that there was input, that there was initiative on the part of the Bnei Yisrael. We need to move further to Sefer Devarim, Perek Aleph Pasuk Kaf Beis. Vatikruvuna leikulchem, Moshe Rabbeinu says, you came to me, vatomur nishlecha anoch noshim lefaneinu, let's send people, v'yachbur lanu es ha'aretz. And there was a whole discussion, which we have had on a different occasion, as to how it can be and why it would be that this is a key aspect of the story that is not mentioned, quote-unquote, in real time, but only in retrospect. Be that as it may, originally it was the Bnei Yisrael who had the idea of sending Meraglim. And now the question is, when did they have this idea, if we may ask? Intuition certainly says that as soon as they saw themselves heading towards Eretz Canaan, the idea comes up of Lishnecha Anoshim Lefaneinu. Moreover, the Tana de Ve'eliyahu tells us that actually, very soon after crossing the Yam Suf, as far as the Bnei Yisrael is concerned, they don't know that they're going to be there. Certainly not for 40 years, and maybe not even for 40 days. Achadasar Yom Echorev. It's only from Har Sinai, it's only 11 days. And therefore, says the Tana de Ve'eliyahu, no sooner had they crossed the Yam Suf, okay, the Yam Suf is behind us, Eretz Canaan is in front of us, Nishlecha Anoshim Lefaneinu. Now, if that's true, then we need to confront a different question. If the push on the part of the Bnei Yisrael to send Meraglim was relatively early, and yet we know that Parshas Shelach happened a year and a half later, so why is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's response, so to speak, was delayed? He either agrees with their idea or doesn't. And if he agrees, so they asked for it a long time ago, and if the answer is no, then it's always no. So why was it that the acquiescence, so to speak, was deferred until this point? Which is a good question. Say the Mefarshim, that's Rashi's question. And in his source, that's the Medrash's question. In other words, what we're dealing with here is not a classic case of Smichus Parshas in terms of the juxtaposition of sections of the Torah. About that, there is no question. You cannot ask, why did the Torah write about Meraglim soon after writing about the section of Miriam? Nothing happened in between them. There's no reason for the Torah not to write about one of them immediately after the other. But the question of Smichus Parshas here is not about the juxtaposition of sections of Torah. It's about the juxtaposition of the events themselves. As if to say, why was it that the Parsha, the episode of the Meraglim, was timed so soon after Miriam? It's been in the works for a long time. They've been petitioned months ago. To that, the answer is, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu waited until the Bnei Yisrael and the Meraglim that represented them would have ample evidence of the consequences of speaking negatively when they shouldn't be speaking in that way. In other words, had HaKadosh Baruch Hu said yes straight away, they would have proceeded, and it would have been all the more dangerous because there's no impediment for them. They haven't seen anyone get burnt by speaking Lashon Hara, and therefore they don't have that deterrent. HaKadosh Baruch Hu therefore waited and delayed until Vatedaber Miriam Ba'aron, and then Miriam suffered in her context for speaking Lashon Hara, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, now let us revisit the plan to send Meraglim, because if there is ever a Shas HaKosha, nothing is guaranteed. Everyone has Bechira, and in the end the Meraglim chose wrong. But that doesn't mean that the climate cannot be chosen which is most conducive to a positive outcome, and that timing is best chosen immediately after Miriam. And the truth is, the phraseology of the Medrash Rabbah, which is Rashi's source, states, V'loma ne'emra shlach lecha anoshim achar parshas Miriam. So it's very interesting if we are medactic, if we are specific, that the Medrash isn't asking about the writing of the Parsha of Shelach. It's asking about the saying of the Parsha of Shelach, namely about the episode itself. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu say Shlach Lecha at that time? The answer is, it was considered a fortuitous time. Hopefully, the lesson would be learnt. That was the hope. But of course, again, the Meraglim chose otherwise. And what's very interesting is, there is an inkling of an indication within the Pasuk itself. As the Perush Be'er Basodeh, Rav Menachem Danun, one of the great Mefarshi Rashi, brings us back to the final Pasuk in Parshas Ba'alosecha, or actually if we go two Pesukim back, Batisager Miriam Michutz L'machana Shivas Yomim, so Miriam is quarantined for 7 days, V'ha'am lo nasa ati yaseif Miriam. And they didn't move, right, L'chvod Shel Miriam, they didn't move as long as Miriam was sectioned away. Pasuk Tet Zayin, the final pasuk, V'achar nosu ha'am echatzerus v'yachanu b'midbar para. After that, they moved from Chatzerus to Midbar Para. It says the Be'er Basodeh, everything that the Torah tells us happens chronologically, unless we know otherwise. The movements of Bnei Yisrael are normally phrased as v'yisu mechatzerus v'yachanu b'midbar para. Why is it that here the Torah doesn't content itself, so to speak, by saying v'yisu from A and went to B, but rather points out v'achar. After that, they moved to Midbar Paran. It seems that the Pasuk is also directing our attention to the fact that it was only after the episode with Miriam happened that they were able to go to Midbar Paran. Take note that after Miriam had been quarantined for 7 days, then they were able to move, because that is the time to send Meraglim, if any. So this is the classic response to Rashi's, to understanding what it is that's bothering Rashi in the first place, Lama Nismecha, and the answer is they should have taken a lesson. But now the question is, what is the lesson, if we examine? They saw Miriam, she was punished, they should have known better not to speak disparagingly. But we need to weigh against each other the two entities that we're referring to. Miriam spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is a person, as far as we understand, there exists a concept of Lashon Hara about people, first and foremost. The Meraglim spoke negatively about Eretz Yisrael, as the Pasuk says in Tehillim, Vayim Asu Be'eretz Chemda. To draw an equation between Lashon Hara about a person and Lashon Hara about a place, I mean, that yet takes some doing. What is the nature of that equation? Perhaps they could legitimately fail to learn the lesson from Miriam. Miriam suffered because she spoke about a person. A person has feelings. Even Moshe Rabbeinu is on of Mikol Adam, as the Torah states there. But was it an absolute imperative that this will lead to the conclusion not to speak about Eretz Yisrael? It doesn't really seem to have the human factor. Where is the Lashon Hara here? But the Mefarshim point out, and it's always important to remember, Eretz Yisrael is the place that it is because that's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu has chosen for Bnei Yisrael to be. That is the ultimate location for Bnei Yisrael. And he refers to it as Eretz Chemda and Eretz Avas Chalav Udvash. We need to appreciate that behind speaking Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael is essentially speaking Lashon Hara about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because what you're saying is, Hashem has told us this is a good place, but we've been there and we think it's a bad place, which means we think he is leading us to a bad place. That's Lashon Hara against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that being the case, there is ample room to learn for someone, on the contrary, it's now a Kal Vachomer from finite to infinite, that someone spoke Lashon Hara about Moshe Rabbeinu and paid the price. Certainly, Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael is Lashon Hara about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He said this is the desired land. To say otherwise is to second-guess HaKadosh Baruch Hu's choice for where the Bnei Yisrael should be. We should note, by the way, the Talmud tells us in Maseches Ksuvos just about Eretz Chemda, speaking about Eretz Yisrael positively, negatively. in the final daf of Maseches Ksubas, they speak at length about Eretz Yisrael. And the Talmud tells us there about the practice of two of the Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi. And it describes the way they would conduct their shir. They would have the shir outdoors, and they would move the Talmidim mitzel lechama u'michama letzel, from the shade to the sun, from the sun to the shade. What is the meaning of this? As Rashi explains, the shir began in the morning. In the morning, it's cooler. And because it's cooler, if a person is in the shade in the morning, sometimes it's too cold because there isn't even sunlight to warm him. And therefore, they were medakdek that as the shir began, people should not be sitting in the shade. Why? So that they shouldn't say, it's cold here. Because the here in that sentence is Eretz Yisrael. And Eretz Yisrael is not too cold. If you move into the sun, it's just right. Mitzel lechama. Then, as the shir progressed, as things heated up, talmudically and also weather-wise, so the day became hot. And to be in the sun can be too hot. And people may say, it's hot here. That's not nice. It's not too hot. Move into the shade, it's just fine. Because here is Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael is just fine. And therefore, in order to avoid someone saying even a comment like that, and when you think about it, by the way, it's hardly a comment with regards to Eretz Yisrael as opposed to Chutz La'aretz, because the surrounding countries are equally hot. It doesn't mean to say that around about noontime, it's too hot in Israel, but it would be just fine in Egypt or Syria. It's the Middle East. It gets hot during the middle of the day. And therefore, it doesn't even sound like it's talking disparagingly about Eretz Yisrael as opposed to Chutz La'aretz. Nonetheless, if anything could be avoided to say something negatively about Eretz Yisrael, that is not Bittul Torah. That is worthwhile. Because if you're in Eretz Yisrael, one should only say positive things about it. And that's a very interesting lesson. If we are to learn, both from Miriam and from the Meraglim, that's a lesson l'doros. So these are comments with regards to the first Rashi, and we are already sensitive to the very delicate and dangerous nature of this delegation to Eretz Yisrael, how important it is to see the positive, and how unfortunately the Meraglim failed to see that. And the Bnei Yisrael, our ancestors, received their negative report. It's interesting to see how, again, in the preparatory phases of this delegation, to see the forces in play. We know that each of the Shvatim has one representative, and they are mentioned by name. As we know, of course, Yosef, whenever it comes to matters of Eretz Yisrael, is divided into two, Ephraim and Manasseh. And indeed, each of them had a delegate. In Pasuk Ches, we find Lemate Ephraim, actually Lemate Ephraim, for those who are of the Ashkenazic persuasion, it's a komat there under the word Ephraim, unusually, even though it's a tipcha, because the rule is that the strongest pause, as we know, a pause can change the pronunciation from patach to komat. Normally, when we think of a pause, we think of an esnachta, or maybe a zokef. I mean, those are the stages in the pasuk where one pauses. A tipcha is the mildest of the pauses. Lahavdil, it looks like a comma, and that's pretty much what it is. The rule is that it's only the strongest pause within the pasuk that can change, that can assume the pausal form. Generally speaking, psukim aren't short enough that the tipcha will be the only pause there. But once in a while, you have it. For example, this pasuk says, Lamatei Ephraim, there is no zokef. There is no esnachta. It's one of those occasions where the tipcha emerges as the strongest pause, and it will change the patach to a komat. Another example, case in point, interestingly, is from last week's parsha. We noted the pronunciation in the section of Korban Pesach. The pasuk says, V'yasu v'nei Yisrael es ha-posach b'moado. Not es ha-pesach, es ha-posach, because once again, it's a short pasuk, and under the word pesach is a tipcha, and It's one of those rare instances where it assumes the role of the mafsik and the pasuk and changes to a comet. In any case, Lamate Ephraim Hoshea ben Nun. Okay, so Ephraim has Hoshea, who, as we know, is Yehoshua. And what about Menashe? So he's to be found in Pasuk Yud Aleph. Lamate Yosef, Lamate Menashe, Gadi ben Susi. Now, Rishonim have already noted that we have an interesting situation here. After all, both Ephraim and Menashe are sons of Yosef. Now, Yosef is split up into two, Ephraim and Menashe. So now the question is, will Yosef be mentioned as the father of Menashe and Ephraim or not? If yes, then that should be the case in both Pesukim. The Pasuk Ches should have said, Lamate Yosef, Lamate Ephraim, Hoshea ben Nun. And if Yosef is not mentioned because we understand that here there is no Yosef because he has become Menashe and Ephraim, so as surely as Pasuk Ches mentions Ephraim only, so Pasuk Yud Aleph should similarly have mentioned Menashe only. How is it that Yosef is mentioned as the father of one of the sons and not of the other? As they say in classic modern Hebrew English, or yes or no. It should be either both cases or neither, but not just one of them. And there are a number of responses to this question. I would like to take a look at two of them. They're very different from each other. One of them is pure parshanut, but it's a fascinating insight. And it's from the writings of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. How many sons did Yosef have? Well, we know there's Menashe, there's Ephraim. But what we often don't remember is that Yosef had more than two sons. He had two sons who became Shvatim, but he had other children. What happened to them? And how do we know this? Well, it happens to be, it's explicit in the Pasuk. Because in Parshas Vayechi, when Yaakov upgrades Menashe and Ephraim to Shevet status, Ephraim and Menashe, Kiruvin Veshimon, Yuli, he goes on to say, Umoladetecha asher holadeta achareyem lecha yihiyu, al shem acheyem yikaruvin achalasam. Meaning, and any other children that you had after them, they're yours. And when it comes to Nachala, they will be called after their brothers. In other words, they will find their chelek within Menashe and Ephraim. Now, if that's the case, we may ask the question, who between the two do they belong to? Are they divided equally? I mean, Lahura, we can't know. But Rabbi Yaakov suggests that given what we know about Yosef, and specifically how he viewed the positions of Menashe vis-a-vis Ephraim, he put Menashe at Yaakov's right. As far as he's concerned, Menashe is the Bechor, and therefore any extras should go to Menashe. I mean, Mefarshim add, Yosef himself was very sensitive not to favoring the younger over the older, given that which had happened in his own experience, apart from anything else. And therefore, when he saw that his father reached his right hand for Ephraim, Vayera be'enav, he takes extreme measures. He moves Yaakov's hand. He tries to move Yaakov's hand. Menashe's the Bechor, Kizeh Bechor, Sim Yamin Chala. And therefore, says Rabbi Yaakov, it seems clear that Yosef, when he had other children, and they are to accrue to Ephraim or Menashe, that he put them together with Menashe, because as far as he's concerned, Menashe is the Bechor. And if that's the case, then what's very interesting is everyone who is from Ephraim will be together with Ephraim. Everyone who's from Menashe will be together with Menashe, but not everyone who's with Menashe is from Menashe, because you have families who are together with Menashe who are from those other sons that Yosef had. And this is how the Pasuk introduces these two families. Ephraim, it calls only Ephraim. Why? Because Ephraim only has Ephraim. That's it. But when it comes to Menashe, it doesn't call him Menashe only, because Menashe doesn't have Menashe only. Menashe also has the other brothers who were born later. And therefore, the accurate description of Menashe is Lemate Yosef, lemate Menashe. Greater Yosef, specifically Menashe, but not exclusively Menashe. So that is a very interesting approach to this pasuk, and of course it's really something to consider throughout the Torah, for we will find this again, this terminology in Parshas Maaseh. So that's Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, as we said, Parshanut Tehora. The Meshech Chochma has a different approach, and as far as he's concerned, this matter is germane to the issue at hand, the sending of the miraculous. Shevet Menashe is interesting because of all of the Shvatim, half of it is going to end up on the east side of the Yarden. Now, there are a couple of points to consider with regards to Menashe being split in half. Firstly, the petition of the Shvatim to settle on the east side of the Yarden will not happen for another 40 years. I mean, it happens really in Parshas Matos. I mean, we are yet in year two. That's the first point. So no one has really spoken about this, it seems. Moreover, specifically with Menashe, we should note, and it's really a discussion to be developed in Parshas Matos, of the 2.5 tribes, the half of Menashe isn't really involved in the negotiations with Moshe to stay on the east side. It's B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. Menashe come in at the end. There are even those who are of the opinion that it's Moshe's decision to apportion Menashe there as well, as some form of safeguarding for B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven. But the Meshech Chochma understands that even though Menashe are absent by name, that half of Menashe, nonetheless, they were also interested to stay on the east side of the Yarden, which again is, of course, a very complicated parsha and needs its own treatment. Moreover, it's possible, says Meshech Chochma, that already in the second year there was a sense of certain segments of the B'nai Yisrael having a preference to settle on the east side of Eretz Canaan. Now, if that's true, then as Moshe comes to choose a messenger, an emissary from Menashe, there actually is a choice to be made. Namely, there is one half that has a tendency towards crossing over and entering Eretz Canaan. There's another half that has a tendency towards staying on the east side. And therefore, it's a question that is raised with regards to Menashe that doesn't exist in terms of any other Shevet. We find, says Meshech Chochma, the Medrash tells us that one of the hallmark characteristics of Yosef is his sense of connection to Eretz Yisrael. The Medrash tells us, in praise of Yosef, that Yosef hoda ba'artzo. He always spoke openly about where he was from. Hoda ba'artzo. We find, even when he's in the bottom of a pit, in the end of Parshas Vayeshev, he has no prospects. He doesn't know when he's going to see the light of day again. He's talking to the Sarah Mashkim. And how does he describe himself? Ki gunov gunavti me eretz ha'ivrim. I come from the Eretz ha'ivrim. And that's how people knew him for a while, until it wasn't politically correct for him to be an Ivri anymore because he became the prime minister of Egypt. But as far as Yosef is concerned, he'll always say that he's an Ivri. And the Medrash says, Yosef shehoda ba'artzo, nikva ba'artzo. Because he always spoke about his connection to Eretz Yisrael, that's where he's from. He was zocher that that's where he was buried. Amazingly, there is a second half to that Medrash. You never know what the Medrash will say. But the other side of the coin here is Moshe Rabbeinu. And says the Medrash, Moshe shelo hoda ba'artzo. He did not attach himself to the land of his origins. Lo nikba ba'artzo. He was not zocher to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. What is this a reference to? Says the Medrash, because you see, when the daughters of Yisro came back to Yisro, and Yisro says, Mazem yaten lavo, why are you home so early? They said, Ish mitzri hitzilanu miyad haroim. An Egyptian saved us. Says the Medrash, Moshe should have objected. He's not a Mitzri. He's an Ivri. Now, there are 2 points of Chiddush in this criticism. Number one, Yosef originally came from Eretz Canaan, Eretz HaEvrim. He was born there. He really was taken from there. Moshe was born in Mitzrayim. And therefore, he is not naturally as Ivri as Yosef was. Point number two, he never said he's a Mitzri. They said he's a Mitzri. The Al Kulano, to mention the third of the 2 points, is that when Yisro's daughters said, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu, and they called him a Mitzri and he should have objected, he wasn't there. Because Yisro's next words are, where is he? Why did you leave him at the well? Which means Moshe didn't hear them calling him an Ish Mitzri, so he couldn't have objected even if he wanted to. These are very intriguing questions. My uncle Rav Kuperman suggests, it's quite a chiddush in its own way, that what the Medrash means to say is that when Moshe is held that he should have objected to be called a Mitzri, he didn't hear the daughters of Yisro say it, but he did hear about it because HaKadosh Baruch Hu dictated the Torah to him. And when they got to Parshas Shemos, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, write the following, Atomarno Ish Mitzri, Moshe should have put his pen down and objected. I'm not a Mitzri, I'm an Ivri. What a thing to say. He let it go. Mitzri, that's what they said. That's okay. And the expectation was he should have protested being referred to in the Torah as a Mitzri. Okay. But to return to Yosef. So Yosef's midah is hodah ba'artzo. He always values his connection to Eretz Yisrael. If that's the case, says Meshech Chochma, when Moshe Rabbeinu comes to choose an emissary from Shevet Menashe, there are two groups within Menashe. There's the group that doesn't value, all within context, but does not value relatively Eretz Yisrael as highly as the other group. And of course, Moshe, who's looking, and to the extent that he can choose, the most positive outcome, he will choose from the side that wants to go into Eretz Yisrael. And how are they referred to? Says the Pasuk, Lemate Yosef, Lemate Menashe. We know that Menashe is from Yosef. When the Pasuk stresses that Menashe is from Yosef, it's from the Yosef-dika side of Menashe. That is to say, the half of Menashe that has an affinity for Yosef's feelings towards Eretz Yisrael. That was the group that Moshe chose from. So these are very interesting responses to these delicate questions, the nuances of the Pasuk. If we make sure to pay attention as the Pesukim go, especially those 12 Pesukim, they seem to be not perhaps giving us that much information. If we pay attention to the contrast between Ephraim, who's just Ephraim, and Menashe, who's Livnei Yosef, Livnei Menashe. Interestingly, and again, this is all as Moshe is preparing them to go. But they have to make their decisions. And the Parsha of the Meraglim, of course, is a sad and difficult Parsha. It's interesting to note that the Pasuk itself does not call the Meraglim. What we refer to in our parlance as the Parsha of the Meraglim, the spies, the Torah never calls the Meraglim, and the Torah never uses that verb in terms of their mission. V'yiraglu es Eretz Kanaan. The Torah uses a different expression. V'yosuru. Shlach lecha anoshim. V'yosuru es Eretz Kanaan. What is the difference between lasur, with a taf, that is to say, latur, and liragel? So the Ksava Kabbalah points out that latur has a connotation of trying to find a positive outcome. We find, for example, in last week's parsha, Balosecha, the Aron is referred to as traveling before Bnei Yisrael, lasur lehem menucha, in order to establish for them, to work out for them that things should happen as well as they can. Lasur lehem menucha, that it should be easy passage for them. That's latur. Liragel is to seek out the negative. As we find, the very first reference to Meraglim in the Torah is when Yosef accuses the brothers. Meraglim at him, Lirvo says, Ervas ha'orez basim. You've come to seek out the negative. Losur is to seek out the positive, and the Ragel is to seek out the negative. One could say that part of the tragedy of the Meraglim is that they went from being Torim to being Meraglim. They were never told to be Meraglim. They were never told the Ragel. They were told Losur, but somehow their profile changed and they stopped looking Losur and they started looking Leragel. And it's very interesting to note an embodiment of the negative reports that the Meraglim brought back is always to be found in the fruits. Because they came to a place called Nachal Eshkol and they cut from there a cluster of grapes, umin harimonim, umin ateinim, they took a pomegranate, and they took a fig, and they brought them back, and Rashi says in his sources, the Talmud and Masechet Sotah, Daf Lamed Daled, they brought them back in order to comment disparagingly about Eretz Canaan, as if to say, look how enormous these fruits are. And the moral of the story is, if this is what the fruits are like, just imagine what the indigenous population is like. So they meant this to be a negative slant on Eretz Canaan. Ask the Kometz HaMincha, Rav Ehrentreu, the Rav of Munich, how do we know? And the Pasuk says they took the fruit back. It could mean anything. It could be as much for purposes of impressing the Bnei Yisrael. Yeah, they're certainly impressive. They made an impression, that's for sure. So maybe it's a positive impression. How do you know it's a negative impression? But it's clear. No, they meant it to reflect badly on Eretz Canaan. How do we know? So the Kometz HaMincha says that this is another instance where we learn a great deal from how this episode is recorded in Parshas Devarim. Because it goes over again the Nachal Eshkol section of their trip. And whereas in our pasuk it says they came to Nachal Eshkol and they took the fruit and they brought it back. In Parshas Devarim, it says something else. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Dalet, Vayavou ad Nachal Eshkol, Vayiraglu Osa. That is the only reference we find during their mission to Rigul, to them being Miraglim. Miraglim has the connotation of giving a negative slant to things, seeking out the negative. If they came to Nachal Eshkol, and the Pasuk says, Vayiraglu Osa, they related to it as Meraglim. That means whatever they did there, and whatever they took back from there, is to give a negative impression. And moreover, we should know, and this is very interesting, just basic Lashon HaKodesh. The Pasuk states in Devarim there, Vayavou ad Nachal Eshkol, Vayiraglu Osa. If we read it slowly enough, we should appreciate that there's been a grammatical shift. Nachal, a stream, is Loshon Zohar. So why does the Pasuk say they came to Nachal Eshkol by Yiraglu Oso? It should say by Yiraglu Oso. It's the Nachal. Of course, this would beg another question. How do you spy a stream? What does that mean? What exactly is it? How is it the all-important Nachal Eshkol? Everything is made or broken depending on their reports about Nachal Eshkol. I wonder if they even encountered Nachal Eshkol on the way into Eretz Canaan. They just crossed over it in one of their campaigns. But the point is, the significance of Nachal Eshkol is it was a turning point for them. This is where it registers in the Torah's terminology that they were already interacting with the land as Meraglim. Not only to Meragel, to reflect the negative of that stream. Not only Vayiraglu Oso, but Vayiraglu Osa. Osa is the land in general. Eretz is Loshon Nekeva. And that is how we are given indications from the Pasuk that whatever they did in Nachal Eshkol, it was not to create a positive impression. We should note, by the way, there is a statement in the name of the Arizal that the mitzvah of Bikurim, which of course does so many things, but amongst them it comes as a response and a rectification of the chet of the Meraglim. as we know, Bikurim are the first fruits, but they're not just any first fruits. They are specifically from the Shivas Haminin. The Shivas Haminin, Peirush Shenishtabcha Bem Eretz Yisrael. Because to counter the negative reports about Eretz Yisrael, so we bring the Bikurim, the Shivas Haminim, to speak in Shvach of Eretz Yisrael. And there is a classic comment in this regard that is made by Rav Menachem Zemba, Zatzal, Hashem Yimkom Gdomo, was killed in the Warsaw Ghetto. He was one of the Gaonim of Warsaw. And he directs our attention to a Mishnah in Bikurim. There is Masechet Bikurim, of course, and the Mishnah raises the question, how do you know what's the Bikurim? How are you meant to remember? You identified at the time when the first fruits ripen. It says the Mishnah, Odom Yorid Tov Sadeyu. A person goes down to his field. Veroeh, and if he sees, Eshkol, Anovim Shebikru, grapes that are ripening. Rimon Shebikeh, pomegranates ripening. Te'enu Shebikru, a fig that's ripening. And then he ties a red band around it. To my knowledge, that is the only positive use for a red band being tied around anything. So this is the Mishnah, and Rav Menachem Zemba raised a simple question. We know that Bikurim, in principle and practice, applies to all of the Shivas Haminim. So when the Mishnah gives us the examples of fruits that ripen, why does it give us these three specifically? Why not mention all seven? Or why not content himself with just one? Says Rav Menachem, based on the Arizal, we understand. The Mishnah gave us three specific examples of fruits ripening. Grapes, pomegranates, and figs. Those are the three fruits that were brought back by the Meraglim in order to spread a disparaging report about the nature of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, as true as it is that Bikurim accrues to Peros, the Shivas Haminim, generally, but there is room for an honorary special mention of these fruits specifically, which the Mishnah gives them. So that's a way to learn Mishnayos. So what happens, and the Meraglim come back, and they spread a negative report, and Bnei Yisrael believe them, and Moshe davens for them, in Perek Yudalad, Pasuk Yutes. Slachno, these are of course well-known words to us, we say them in Slicha, Slachno la'om, lo la'om azeku golu chastecha. Forgive this people, they're Aveira. V'kashen osas olam azeh mitzrayim v'adheina, as you have done until now. V'yomer Hashem, salachti kidvarech. And Hashem says, okay, I forgave them. Now, if we just read these two psukim, we would get the impression that we were in trouble and slated to be punished. Moshe davens for forgiveness, and Hashem forgives us. Forgiveness sounds like we're off the hook. But the next psukim, the next good few psukim, describe in detail how that entire generation is to die out in the Midbar and not to go into Eretz Canaan. The very next psukim, Pasuk Avalef, Ulam Chayoni, Vimalekvod Hashem is Kala Ares, Kikol Anoshim Ores, Kavodi Ves Ososai, Asher Sisi Bimitzrayim, etc. Pasuk Avgimel, Imu Ues Haaretz, Asher Nishbati Lavosam. They're not going to see the land. So they never really went in. But whatever happened to their Slicha? Moshe Adavin, for they should be forgiven. And Kodesh Baruch Hu says, Salafti Kidvarecha, and then they all died in the Midbar. What type of Slicha is that? We should know, and this is an important discussion in the Rishonim, that there are those who are of the opinion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not forgive them. As we see from the Imsum Sukkim, they did not enter Eretz Canaan. But the Pasuk says, Salachti Kidvarecha, Hashem says, I've forgiven them, like you asked. Says the Chizkuni, and the Dasakeni Mibale Atosvos, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds with the word Salachti Kidvarecha, he's not talking about the Meraglim. But how can he not be talking about the Meraglim? Isn't that the issue at hand? Let's have a look again at Pasuk Yotes. Moshe asks, Slach no, forgive now. La'avon amazek godo chastecha. Forgive their sin. V'kasher nasasa la'amazem mitzrayim v'adhena. Just like you've forgiven them from Mitzrayim until now, so forgive them now as well. To that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds, Salachti kidvarecha. I did forgive them, like you said. But not now. Moshe is asking that they should be forgiven now, like they were forgiven then. HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds, I forgave them then, but I will not forgive them now. Salachti is actually a reference to the earlier Nasasal Mimitzrayim Vadhena. And that is why we find throughout Chazal and the Medrash, Rashi quotes it in Parshas Ekev, that Salachti Kidvarecha is a reference to the Egel. For the Egel, I forgave them, not for the Meraglim. That's an important Parshanut position. And should we ask the question, if we may ask, why? Why were they forgiven for the Egel, and why were they not forgiven for the Meraglim? I mean, one's an Aveira, one's an Aveira. We don't take either lightly, but if they're forgiven for the first one, why not for the second? So the Rechaim HaKodesh says a very sobering thought. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says in Pasuk Yud Beis, at the end of the Pasuk, Vayinasu osi ze eser pa'amin. They tested me these 10 times, lo shamu bekoli. What that means is that the Bnei Yisrael, they don't seem to have any deterrent from sinning. And the reason why is because whenever they get into trouble, Moshe can daven for them, and then they can get out of trouble. Now, the Mishnah tells us, actually, it's a well-known Mishnah, at the end of Maseches Yuma, if a person says, I'll do an Aveira, and then I'll do Tshuva, and he's got it all worked out, he has the whole schedule, first Aveira, and then Tshuva, and it will all work out, Ein maspik biyado la'asos tshuva. Tshuva is by no means a simple idea. And as the Rogatch of Gaon explains, because tshuva is actually the source of his aveira. If there were no concept of tshuva, he wouldn't do an aveira. So that can't be the source of his kapara. Ein kategor na'asos sanegor. The existence of tshuva was actually part of what led him to sin. It's obviously can get very involved in that way. But what that means is that at a certain point, and the stress of ze eser pa'amim means 10 times, they'll never stop. Because why should they not do? Why should they not sin? They can always do tshuva in the end. They can always get Moshe to daven for them in the end. And therefore, in order to preempt subsequent innumerable disasters, there comes a certain point that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides that tshuva will not help them. And in a sense, that is the greatest chiddush of Parshas Shelach. That Bnei Yisrael did an Aveira, that they'd done Aveiras before. But Tshuva did not help. And we see, it's the saddest part in a sense, or certainly one of the very tragic segments of Parshas Shelach, is the next day Bnei Yisrael, they're up, they're ready to go. Hinenu, va'alinu, va'yapilu. We're ready to go. In other words, they couldn't fathom the fact that if they really do want to go, everything must be okay. Isn't everything always okay once we say we're sorry? And Moshe said it will work out badly. The Aaron is not with you, Hashem is not with you. It's not going to work. And they didn't believe him. As far as they're concerned, that's a heresy. It's always okay in the end. And it wasn't okay. And certainly the roots. Now, we don't like to talk about it until that day is mamash upon us, but the roots of Tisha B'Av is in Parsha Shelach, and one cannot escape the feeling, one reads through Parshas Eicha, Megillas Eicha, that as much as it has a sense of tragedy, it also has a sense of shock, because there's a number of psukim throughout Megillas Eicha which basically have the Jewish people davening and nothing happens, and they're sorry, and it's too late. And they're doing tshuva, and it doesn't matter. And you see that the Navi goes over it again and again because it's the most unbelievable part of the whole story. But in a sense, that has to be there sometimes, because otherwise tshuva becomes a joke, and there is no impediment at all to doing any aveiros, and therefore Parsha Shelach is an absolute tragedy. As far as these Mefarshim is concerned, not only was it an Aveira, but Tshuva was not an option at that on that account. And we find that in Yisrael, we don't hear that many Aveiras from them beyond that point. Other Mefarshim, however, understand that Salachti Kidvarecha, unlike the Chizkuni that we mentioned, that it's a reference to the Egel, they understand that it really is a reference to the Meraglim. Of course, our question is, well, if Salachti, Hashem forgave the Meraglim, if that's true, then why are they all punished and they can't go into Eretz Canaan? That doesn't sound like Slicha, that sounds like it didn't help. Except we need to remember what was the original sentence against them, and then what ultimately happened. In Pasuk Yudalid, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Akenu v'debe v'orishenu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling Moshe that he is prepared to wipe them out straight away. Pasuk Yud Beis, pardon me. Akenu v'debe v'orishenu. They will be deleted. Ve'eseh socha l'goy gadol v'tzumimenu. So the original proposed punishment for Bnei Yisrael is they should be destroyed immediately. Moshe intercedes on their behalf, and he emphasizes what is often the last resort, namely the issue of Chilul Hashem. If you kill them, they'll say that B'sham Mitzrayim, they'll say you weren't strong enough to bring them to Eretz Canaan, and then no one will take monotheism seriously. And therefore there was a certain acquiescence. Moshe was correct to argue that point, and of course it is a correct point, and the sentence is, so to speak, revised. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Salachti Kidvarecha. You've asked me to forgive them. I've forgiven them. In other words, the original punishment was that the Jewish people will be destroyed. You can imagine such a thing. And Moshe says, if the Jewish people are destroyed, then they'll say you couldn't bring them into Eretz Canaan. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Salachti Kidvarecha. So I have forgiven that entity called the Jewish people. But the Jewish people is more than the sum of its parts. Each of the individuals who were party to the receiving and reacting to the negative reports, they are not the sole bearers of the concept called the Jewish people. They have children, and their children will become the Jewish people tomorrow. And therefore, but what's interesting is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't say Salachti. He says Salachti Kidvarecha. Kidvarecha isn't just Dovah B'Shem Omro, just like you said. Salachti Kidvarecha means I've forgiven them in the way that you said it. You were arguing that the Jewish people need to be remained. They can't be wiped out. Salachti Kidvarecha, in accordance with what you argued, I've forgiven them. The Jewish people will not be wiped out. But these individuals will not go in to Eretz Canaan. That said, we should note that even for that generation, the Dor HaMidbar, there was something of a clemency. How so? After all, we're asking the question. I mean, they weren't able to go into Eretz Canaan. It sounds like nothing changed. There was no mitigation for the benefit of that generation. But that's actually not true. Because if we take a look at Pasuk Lamed Dalet, where the future of that generation is being described, b'mispar hayamim asher tartemes haaretz, just like the number of days that you toured the land, reconnoitred the land, arba'im yom, for 40 days, yom lashana, tisu es avonoseichem arba'im shana, so you will bear that sin for 40 years. Now, there's a couple of questions. The simple understanding is that corresponding to every day that the Meraglim were in Eretz Canaan, so they're punished for a year. Yom Lashana, Yom Lashana. So firstly, the question is, well, how does that, if we may ask, how does that seem fair? If they sinned for a day, why should they be punished for a year? It doesn't even sound like Midas Hadin, let alone Midas HaRachamim. But secondly, and this is a fascinating point, pointed out by Rabbeinu Bachya and others, The way we would have said it, or the way we intuit what the pasuk is saying, is that they have to stay in the Midbar a year corresponding to every day that they were in Eretz Canaan. That's the sentence. If that's true, then the pasuk shouldn't say Yom L'Shana. It should say Shana L'Yom. A year for every day. Yom L'Shana means a day for every year. But there was no every year. There were only days. It's a year for a day. That's Shana L'Yom, not Yom L'Shana. Which is a good shaila. And this question is addressed by Rav Zalman of Volozhin, the youngest brother of Rav Chaim of Volozhin. And there are collected Divrei Torah from him. There was a biography called Toldos Odom, written by one of the Rabbonim of Vilna, about Rav Zalman. And it's essentially a collection of Divrei Torah, which apparently is all that he did, so it really is a biography. The punishment of the Meraglim is that they will not enter Eretz Canaan. Now, if that's true, so then we need to be sure that we're accurate in terms of the options. The option is not to stay in the Midbar as opposed to going into Eretz Canaan. They're not going to go into Eretz Canaan. They will die in the Midbar. The only question is, when? Now, Midas Hadin says you were there for 40 days, so you'll die over the course of 40 days. That's Midas Hadin. The rachamim, the clemency shown to Bnei Yisrael, is they're not going into Eretz Canaan, but they're not going to die in the next 40 days. Life in the Midbar is also life, especially given the alternative. And moreover, I mean, if they die at the age of 60, I don't know what the average life expectancy in those days was, but all things considered, and again, put against the alternative of dying over the course of the next 40 days, that's the rachamim for Bnei Yisrael. Yom L'Shana, each day will become a year. And they are now guaranteed another 40 years of life, as opposed to 40 days. Because going into Eretz Canaan is not an option. They either die now, or they have another 40 years to live. That's Yom L'Shana. Every day that should have been just a day of punishment becomes spread out over a year. But it remains a day, because as we know, it was only one day a year that they were punished. That's Tisha B'Av. So it remains 40 days, but those 40 days are spread out one day per year, Yom L'Shana. But what we do see is there exists a correspondence, a consonance, between the term of Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar, 40 years, that evolved out of 40 days. And why 40? Because they were in Eretz Yisrael for 40 days. And Shlomo Kluger asked the question, what's the Midah Keneged Midah? What's the measure for measure? They were in Eretz Canaan for 40 days, so now they will die out over 40 days, which become 40 years. But what difference does it make how long they were in Eretz Canaan for? As if to say, the problem was not that they went to Eretz Canaan. That's actually a good thing. The problem is they came back and they said bad things about it, which means that their wrongdoing is not being in Eretz Canaan. Their wrongdoing is spreading a negative report. So if you want to have a measure for measure in terms of, so maybe see how many words they said. If they said 40 words, so that's something to work with. But the fact that they reported having been in Eretz Yisrael for 40 days, being in Eretz Yisrael wasn't the problem. Coming back and saying what they said was the problem, that's Kana Kelev Kavur. That's the source of the problem. So why is the correspondence of their punishment to the time they spent in Eretz Canaan? Says Rav Shlomo Kluger, the reason is because the roots of the sin really were in the time that they were in Eretz Canaan. Because they came back and reported what they saw. The problem began with what they saw, or what they didn't see, or how they saw it. What the person sees, that's what he describes. So their negative report was nothing more, nothing less than a verbal expression of their negative vision of Eretz Yisrael. And for every day that they were in Eretz Yisrael, and all they saw was negative, that's where the punishment is. And therefore that becomes the metric for the sentence of the Bnei Yisrael, Arboim Yom, which become Arboim Shana. And this, of course, is an all-important lesson for us, not only in talking about Eretz Yisrael, in talking about other people, in talking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as we saw, they're all connected in the Parsha here. What a person says is often purely a function of what they see. And therefore, the antidote in the beginning of the rectification doesn't begin in the mouth, it begins in the eye. If a person sees positive, if a person speaks positive. And thus we find, and it's unavoidable, the parsha which begins V'yasur as Eretz Canaan ends with the injunction V'lo sasuru acharei levavchem v'acharei neichem. The pasuk doesn't even talk about lo sasuru acharei lashonchem. It doesn't tell you don't say bad things. If you don't sway after your heart and after your eyes, but rather you see things as they really are, so your mouth will take care of itself. If you see positive, then you'll only have positive things to say. That's the enduring message, L'sha'ul Adoros, from Parshas Shelach.